Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. Please note you can now find information about episodes on Instagram and Facebook at The Bookshop Podcast rather than on my author pages. So please follow me there and at Mandy Jackson Beverly Author if you'd like to know more about my books, the workshops I offer, and conferences where I'm speaking. You can also go to my website at mandyjacksonbeverly.com and sign up for my newsletter. Enjoy the show. I've been thinking a lot about time lately, so here's a little piece I wrote called Time. Time constantly confronts us, dangling her innocence, a cobweb caught in a breeze, a lawnmower in the distance, the cold nose of a dog reminding us of his presence. Time, a baby's first cry, a first kiss, a final breath. Time is a welcome pause from the madness, the noise, the anger. Time lapses into age, from child to crone to spirit. Time restores and heals, culminates, terminates, waxes and wanes. A string of moments, memories, fading, lost. Hannah Oliver Depp is the owner of Loyalty Bookstores in Petworth, D.C. and Silver Spring, Maryland. Loyalty serves all readers as an intersectional, feminist bookstore and programming space. Hannah holds a master's in English from American University and is a founding member of the American Booksellers Association's Committee on Diversity, Equity and Inclusion, and serves on the boards of Bookshop.org, an open book foundation, and the New Atlantic Independent Booksellers Association. Hi, Hannah, and welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's great having you here.
It's wonderful to be here.
Now, you are the owner of Loyalty Bookstores with two locations, Petworth, D.C. and Silver Spring, Maryland. You have a master's in English from American University, and prior to owning the bookshops, you are a teacher and bookseller. What inspired you to open Loyalty Bookstores?
Those things. Everything. Finding bookselling was definitely a experience of like, oh, this is what I was made for. I deeply, deeply love academia. I miss it. I plan on going and getting a dozen more degrees simply for the fact that I love school and I love teaching. But the way academia works right now, especially in the States, is, and you know, there's people doing wonderful on the ground work to change this. But as with everything, it is struggling with any real true change in the realms of diversity and representation. And what is rewarded is not necessarily engagement with your students and caring about teaching, which is, you know, wonderful, watching wonderful people get pushed out of the profession because they were more concerned with making sure their students were getting a great education than playing the game was really disheartening. I had no real illusions about all that going into it, but what really did surprise me was how resistant academia still was to the fact that I was a whole person, that I had been working since 9 years old to pay for college and to pay for grad school, and that those things had influenced my experiences, influenced what kind of academic I was. And I thought that was a great thing. And I was lucky to have an experience at American University where that was rewarded, but they were very clear. They're like, this is not the general case. And, you know, as I worked towards my PhD and as I looked at the job market, that really proved to be true. And I had grown up on and off. I stayed with a lot of different relatives growing up. I had a pretty wild upbringing. And as a result, one of my many homes was really close to Politics and Prose, which is a famed bookstore here in Washington, D.C. And so I grew up there. And then when I came back to Washington, D.C., which I considered my home, and I was finally coming home and I was going to live my adult life in Washington, D.C. finally, I was stunned by a few things. One, the rampant gentrification that was changing the very fabric of my city. It was known as Chocolate City, my childhood. This is where I came to connect with my people. It's why I always identified it as my home. And they were being removed rapidly from their homes via taxation laws, development laws. The March of Progress was bulldozing them. And I did not enjoy seeing that. But in the middle of this were independent bookstores that I'd grown up with, like Politics and Prose and Sankofa, which is another famed legendary bookstore across the street from Howard University. American University happens to be very close to Politics and Prose. And so it was literally someplace I could walk to. And I, while finishing up my thesis, got a job bookselling there. And the extremely long-winded way of finally answering your question is, suddenly, I was rewarded for having worked retail my entire life. I was rewarded for having built sets in theater and having a visual mind. I was rewarded for my ability to communicate and explain complex ideas to people who had 5 minutes to learn something or to think about something or were taking a very quick break in their day to spend some time in the world of letters. And on the flip side of that, my obsessive academic nature was also rewarded because of the deep amount of reading and critical thinking it takes to be. It never stops. There's thousands of books you get sent every year and you're trying to get through them all. And, you know, if there's anything I can do, it's read quickly. And so suddenly all the parts of me found a home. Booksellers are sometimes prickly and strange. Sometimes they're outgoing and vivacious. But there is a united love for making sure people know about something you care about so much, which is books, and to truly listen to the customers and to the community you're in. And I was suddenly able to affect immediate change in my community and in my neighborhood by way of this bookstore. And then also because of the standing of the bookstore I was working in the publishing industry, affect change in the publishing industry. And I started to become involved in our regional trade association and our national trade association. Thought, this is where I belong. You know, I need these people and they need me. And I was done for. I was a bookseller from then on. It happened very quickly. I just found my place. From then on, I ended up realizing that if I wanted to have the level of impact on publishing that I was hoping my voice would have, whether that be making sure that authors from traditionally marginalized backgrounds were not only getting their books celebrated, but that when it wasn't just enough to sign those authors, you had to promote them. You had to find booksellers who actually cared about them to champion them, couldn't just throw them out there, you know, to the wolves, or even worse, to a field of crickets. And so getting that kind of attention for mostly for worse, frankly, not for better. The owner of a store is listened to above all else. I thought, well, that's silly. The frontline bookseller is really and truly the lifeblood of the bookstore. And yet, you know, I spend a good chunk of my time fighting with QuickBooks, but I'm listened to often more so than my frontline bookseller. So I wanted to upend that dynamic a little bit, but I realized I would need to be an owner to do that upending that I wanted to do. And so I was like, okay, I will be a transitional figure in this industry. And I will try to bring attention to these things, but to get my voice heard as loudly as I wanted it to be heard, I would need to become an owner. And around 2013 is when I started brainstorming loyalty. I left Politics and Prose to go work at Word Bookstores, which is owned by the brilliant Christine Onorati. They have two locations, one in Jersey City, New Jersey, and one in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, in New York. And I knew that I wanted stores across state lines and that is a very difficult, challenging thing. And I just respected all the things Christine had done as far as nurturing talent in the industry and really challenging a lot of our status quos. So she was a dream person to kind of learn from about how to run a sort of scrappier store. Politics and Prose, I learned like everything you could ever want to know about inventory management and, you know, events programming. And it's a great bookselling education, but also it is so well established. It's a behemoth. It's this giant in the industry, thanks to Barbara and Carla, who started it, you know, almost 40 years ago, and Brad and Lissou, who've taken the reins over. I was like, well, how do you get there? How do you get there? You know, you don't start there in this industry. There's a transitional moment. And so watching Word, which at that point wasn't even 10 years old, sort of become a leading voice, I was like, okay, someone has done this recently and I need to go learn from her. And she opened her mind and her arms to me, and I learned so much. There's a lot to be said for the way that booksellers take care of each other and really share resources with each other. And from then, it was a matter of staying connected to my people in DC and making sure that I had still a foot in this community, even though I was away from home for a little while, and really growing my publisher connections and making sure that I truly understood the life cycle of the book and of this business. Because if I wanted to shake the system, I had to understand the system.
And the space you're currently in DC, was that previously a bookstore?
It was, yes. So there was a bookshop that I was consulting for. I pretty much worked full-time as a consultant along with working full-time as a bookseller, and wrote a lot of articles and did a lot of copy editing in order to save up money to start a pop-up. Because as you might remember, bookselling is not a lucrative job.
A bit like being an author.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And so I was consulting with another store, and the owner was looking to sell. And so we worked out a deal where I basically, you know, traded labor to take over that storefront.
Did you make many changes to the store?
Yes. We closed it down. We rebranded. We did a pop-up together over the holidays, which allowed me to sort of get my foot in the door and make sure I really did know what the community was looking for. And we were able to meet that. And then we did a pop-up in 2018 together. And then that store closed in the end of 2018. And in 2019, Loyalty opened its doors in the Petworth neighborhood of DC. The next step was that we continued to look for a space in downtown Silver Spring, which is where I had some family. And I had fond memories of being in a Borders as a child in middle school, you know, after theater practice, hanging out in the Borders, being all cool. And that store had closed 10 years ago and nothing had replaced it. There was a very cool used bookstore in town, but there was not a new store. And an interesting shift was happening as well in with the developers and the landlords, where they were realizing, as attractive as a lease from a big box store or a national chain company or restaurant is, because it's, you know, frankly reliable, you sort of trust them to pay their bills, you know, to a certain extent until it's not remotely lucrative, and then they're out of there. They don't care about the community. They're not going to try to stay. It's all about the bottom line. So, you know, it might look good on paper, but A, those chains cycle out a lot and leave a lot of empty storefronts, and also big giant storefronts, which then you can't, no one else can lease, right? You build out this giant development for them and then they can't do it. Whereas small businesses are unique and people are less and less inclined to leave their house for a big box experience, right? Because they need something at the last minute, or, you know, maybe it is more convenient, especially in a city, to just sort of step out of your door and see what's there. But they were losing their downtown because it was wholly big box commercial. And they were starting to really chase local retailers to open locations in what were formerly big box locations. And it was a very interesting experience to work with a, you know, national development company and say, like, no, this is what a small business needs. And, you know, I can be really scrappy. I can make almost any space you give me work. I can design my way, I can display my way around weird pillars and a weird, you know, this used to be a restaurant, fine, we'll figure something out. So you're going to save money on that and you're going to pass those on to me so that I can get my foot in and build a community, and we can have this. So we ended up with, you know, after almost a full year of negotiation, a really great lease in downtown Silver Spring, but it took a year of conversation and education and using the ABA sort of models and information that they supply us with of saying, like, look, this is the profit margin. I'm not making this up. And saying even stores that, you know, the few stores that make millions of dollars a year, their profit margin is 1%.
And now you have these two fabulous stores. Is there a vast difference between your customers in the two areas' tastes? And I'm sure this must affect how you curate the stores.
Absolutely. It's very funny you should say this. We just had a training call today with our staff about the best way they can use our online ordering platform that independent bookstores use called Edelweiss or Above the Tree Line. And it's literally the publishers feed their catalogs in, and it's hundreds of catalogs and a bazillion titles. And we have to sort of weave our way through it to build orders. My sales reps, who from the publishers, share their markups with me on this platform. I go through them, and I also share them with our staff and our, again, this, the frontline bookseller being the lifeblood, the true, you know, genius of an independent bookstore.
And just one thing for my listeners, can you please explain what a markup is?
Oh, of course. So these massive catalogs, which vary in size, you have, you know, what we sort of think of as the publisher, or the imprint, you know, say that's Viking or it's Catapult, you know, an independent, and, you know, and they are often distributed by larger publishers or vendors, and these giant conglomerate publishing groups. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're looking at a publisher's catalog and we're saying, okay, what books from Catapult, this publisher of great independent writers, are we going to bring into the store? If we're lucky enough to have a sales representative from that distributor who distributes Catapult, they send me what's called a markup, which is literally everything. You know, it depends on the sales rep. Nothing is standard in this industry. It can be anything from tags and annotations on the description of the book about why it might matter to my store, such as that it is written by, say, like a Black queer woman, which is something that we would definitely go out of our way to amplify at Loyalty, or that it's a local author to the DC area, or, you know, sometimes they even go so far as to make, you know, quantity suggestions, which we are free to ignore or accept or, you know, whatever. I, as you said, have multiple locations. But both stores have a guiding principle, which is that Loyalty is here to, you know, flip everything upside down. And so whereas, you know, in a store, the majority of authors on the shelf are going to be heterosexual white men, able-bodied, presenting as neurotypical. I think very few of them probably are, as we learn more and more about it. But that's going to be the vast body followed by that, except for female presenting. We are basically saying, oh, that is actually the minority at Loyalty. That, you know, that is, we have, I think, one Fitzgerald on the shelf. And it's Tender as the Night, because that's one of my favorites. It's just a personal favorite of mine. We're lucky. We are Washington, D.C. We have oodles of bookstores, and hopefully we'll have oodles more soon. It's a reading city. It's a city very invested in its neighborhoods. And so I don't need to make sure I'm everything to all people. I can really focus on my community. The curation comes both from my own execution as the, you know, I am the head buyer for the store as well as the owner. And so I tend to look at the frontlist catalogs as well as make sure that our backlist is reflective. Frontlist being new releases, backlist being older releases, usually a year or more old. And so, of course, that could be anything from classics from 300 years ago to something released literally 2 years ago. Backlist is a big term, big term. It's my job to make sure we have a balance and that we are really making sure it's very easy to have traditional publishing and the traditional major author overwhelm the shelves if you're not really focused on that curation. But that's our job. That's our mission. I think every independent bookstore, first of all, if they're not curating, they're not doing their job. There's no reason for them to exist. It's a very hard job. And so whether or not you state it, your store has a taste and it has personality. And it's a combination of the things people hear about in the news and they walk in and they ask about, the taste of your neighborhood. Maybe your neighborhood loves mysteries. Maybe it's a beach bookstore and people are looking for that kind of beach reading. Maybe it's near university and the professors help curate the shelves. You know, each store has its own flavor. We are what's, you know, often off the cuff known as a mission-based bookstore, meaning we're determined to do something with our store. We are known for that curation, but I also think that pretty much every store is, if it's doing what it's created for, it has a flavor.
Under the National Book Foundation website, it states that Loyalty serves all readers as an intersectional feminist bookstore and programming space. Can you define this a little more and explain how it affects your curation?
You know, it's the Audre Lorde test, I would say. We sort of jokingly were referring to a group of female authors who have really shaped my reading life and kept me sane sort of in the last year is The Seven Sisters. And I was like, actually, this is a really cool reflection of who we sell and why. So it's ranging from mystery authors to romance authors to science fiction authors, nonfiction authors, poets. You know, it's Toni Morrison, it's Audre Lorde, it's N.K. Jemisin, it's Alyssa Cole. The idea is that nobody is free until everybody is free, right? That amazing Fannie Lou Hamer quote. It's a wonderful concept, but it's much, much harder to live out in life, right? We are taught to police each other. We are taught to focus on the negative. We are taught to defy joy. And I'm a delightfully negative person, as I would describe myself. I do find that the idea of intersectional feminism as a guiding principle is that you can't pick and choose your feminism. The idea of not just equality, but digging through and writing what has been done wrong is going to be a long process. It helps remind me that we're not going to fix this all tomorrow, but it needs to be constant and intentional, and it can never just rest on its laurels and be surface. And so it's not enough to say like, oh, it's a book by a woman. And you say, well, that's great. But if that woman is anti-trans, it doesn't matter, because that woman is using her position of privilege, whatever position of privilege she's managed to grab onto in a white supremacist, male-dominated society. Yes, she's had to overcome things to get to that spot. But if then she uses that to then demean people who have less access to privilege, this is not the intersectional feminism that our store is trying to uphold. And so that person will never be faced out and displayed and in a stack of 12 at Loyalty. And in fact, while we often sell people that we disagree with, that is something we do, those are things that we call special orders, mean they're customer requests. And if a customer is requesting them, and we're happy to bring them in, but if the customer asks my opinion, I will let you know that I'm saddened to hear, you know, I'm saddened to learn that this person, this author, is using their position to bring other people down. And may I recommend a different author who's of incredible writing quality, who may also check the box that you're trying to do to be a good person to read, you know, more brown women or more Latinx women or whatever. And quite often people are just very excited to get the recommendation. That's why they're there at the bookstore to begin with.
You contributed to the establishment of the Diversity Task Force, known as the American Booksellers Committee on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for the American Booksellers Association. What is the mission of this committee, and is this a priority for the ABA?
It was a huge priority for Allison when she came on as CEO, and COVID slammed right into that. But at the same time, COVID made it, just like everything, it revealed the great inequities in our culture. And so at first it seemed like, oh no, it's going to get pushed to the side. And then it was like, actually, no, we're going to keep talking about this front and center, because this is why this is important. Because the way that COVID is hitting Black and minority owned businesses in this country, the way it is hitting those people, the way that now vaccines are being distributed, this shows why all of this matters. And it shows why we need to hear our stories more than we ever have, even. It matters how American history is told and taught. It matters that stories about more than Black pain are shown. It matters that we make sure Indigenous voices who were getting destroyed by this plague were getting listened to, because it didn't have to be this way, right? And on and on and on and on. And so I really appreciated that direction that she took, and as hard as that was, and some of it was not perfectly done because those of us on the committee were trying to keep our bookstores open. And doing yet another thing was just not going to happen. But I will say, you know, since Allison and Joy took those two main leadership positions, I've never, ever felt unheard.
Yeah, they're all doing a wonderful job.
Yeah, and by making it a committee, they showed their commitment to this being an ongoing part of the fabric of the organization. That was the thing that I could do in the industry while Trump was in office. And I just served my last meeting, actually, and have handed off to a whole new crop of people on the committee. And that's freaking beautiful that there's a whole new group of people to do it.
It is, yes. And interestingly enough, I think as tough as the past year of the pandemic has been, issues that are routinely swept under the carpet, that have not been confronted, like Black Lives Matter and myriad social injustices, are now in the spotlight. They're front and center stage and cannot be ignored. And these issues certainly came to a head after the 2016 election.
Yeah, Trump was elected and suddenly people were like, oh, maybe something is wrong. And then, you know, it was waxing and waning of people's ability, bandwidth, and willingness to listen. And again, there's a cycle. You know, one of my earlier childhood memories is the Rodney King riots in California and LA. And then there was a, you know, reckoning, and we were talking about it. And I remember these conversations happening, and that's happened a few times in my life. And it's cyclical. And I hope that we just get a little farther every time, but it's awful that every time we get any further in the conversation, it's because of something truly horrific happening to someone that didn't need to happen.
Well, please keep doing what you're doing, and I shall keep doing what I'm doing, but never give up. Now, Hannah, how do you think Instagram has influenced book selling?
Your audience cannot see, but I'm overjoyed at the moment because I love Bookstagram as Instagram books. It's fun. It's so fun. DC has a huge crop of Bookstagrammers. We have so many Bookstagrammers who live locally, either near my Silver Spring location or my Petworth location, or they're close to, say, Mahogany and Anacostia or East City near Capitol Hill. We are really drenched and blessed in Bookstagrammers. And it's a really, really fun community of people who are just deeply enthusiastic about books. I mean, deeply enthusiastic about books.
The quality of some of the photographs of books are absolutely gorgeous. They're stunning.
I know. You know, it was a big part of my business model. Actually, it was Bookstagram was built into my business plan in the before times. We had in real life meetups for Bookstagrammers to come hang out in the store, and we drank some wine and we shared galleys, and we, you know, it was just a wonderful meetup time. We definitely have Bookstagrammers who run, say, a couple of book clubs at the store. They are sometimes in conversation partners for authors. There's really great programs with various different stores in the city that really make use of this amazing resource. You know, they shop at the bookstore. They tell other people to shop at the bookstore. They are way ahead of the curve of, say, traditional reviewing publications at celebrating the full breadth and width of diversity in publishing. They are smart. They are on it. They know editors that they follow. They know cover designers that they follow. They're really sometimes forensic.
The thing about Bookstagrammers is they love books. It doesn't matter if they're from a big publisher, an indie publisher, a small press, a medium press. They just love books and they love to read.
And they celebrate backlist. And I think sometimes publishing looks down on it, which is a very stupid thing to do, because it's why reject someone who wants to promote books? But it's also, I think it's very typical, and this attitude is changing, but the negativity I hear about it usually has to do with, oh, it's just pretty, or it's just cute. And I'm like, really? Have you, interestingly, and you know, sometimes you hear it from other bookstores who don't take it seriously. And they're like, oh, well, it's not translating to sales. And I was like, well, sometimes it's hard to directly make it obvious. I personally have plenty of obvious examples where it's affected my sales, but it's getting the books out into the air so that they're unavoidable and you crave them. It creates a craving, but it's also, that's a very toxic masculine way of looking at it, because something's pretty doesn't mean it's not powerful. It's a female dominated group, although there's plenty of awesome male Bookstagrammers and gender nonconforming Bookstagrammers and queer Bookstagrammers. But because it is so dominated by women, I think people tend to not take its buying power seriously, which is foolish, as women make up the greatest book of book buyers.
Book selling is about building relationships. And that goes for the author to the bookseller in the store, and ultimately the reader. When you're an author and you are at a book festival prior COVID, and someone buys your books, and then they want to take a photo of you with them and the book to post on Instagram, there is nothing better. It's such a great way to build the relationship.
It's absolutely a direct correlation. If you're choosing to sell books this way, in independent bookselling retail, you're about building the relationship with your community, with your readers, and Bookstagram helps you do that. And it's the same. They're interested in that true community.
Hannah, how do you see the quickly shrinking world of big publishers affecting the literary world, you know, indie bookshops and authors?
Monopolies are bad. I understand the position they're in, that they put themselves in, mind you, with Amazon. It's not going to help. We all know it's not going to help them, quote unquote, fight Amazon pricing. It's certainly not going to affect us. We desperately need to have extremely blunt conversations with every publishing house, big or small, about the fact that independent bookstores will not exist in 5 to 10 years if the pricing model stays the same. We are paying insane amounts for the product because other venues that they work with don't pay enough for the book. And I think that books are worth what they're worth. First of all, we're frankly not charging enough for how much it costs to make a book when we're charging the quote unquote sticker price. So they're losing money hand over fist. I understand that the solutions that we're working with right now are fast, quote unquote, problem solvers that will put cash in the pockets in the immediate, but not solve any long-term problems. And they're definitely going to shrink voices.
Yeah, and that's frightening. So do you see the decline of the big publishers purely based on financial need?
It's a combination of running out of money. It's a combination of market share grab, obviously. They think they'll have better, you know, that's one of the reasons they give, is that they'll have better negotiating power with Amazon if they are all one giant conglomerate. But that's not true. Amazon will still have the market share for their books.
I think that's the part I don't comprehend.
I assume it's something that sounds really, really good when you're trying to get a giant merger passed from the treasurer, the treasury department. I think that things like that sometimes help in the short term. Maybe they do. But the fact of the matter is that if we had just trade laws in this country, not even just sensible trade laws in this country, Amazon wouldn't exist as it does. It would never have gotten this far, right? And it's very hard to take something apart that's gotten that big. And the same is true for the publishers all merging together. I understand it from their point of view. I think it's a terrible decision, but I've read the bullet points. I know why they're doing it, but it's short-term solutions to a long-term problem. And as far as that goes, the more power one group has, the less we have. You know, I love my Ingram sales rep and my Ingram contacts, but having one giant wholesaler is a very bad thing for our industry. It's very bad for voices. It's bad for voices in the Midwest who don't get their books as fast shipped to their independent bookstores. It's bad for me, who's a small bookstore who doesn't have the ability to negotiate my price mark as well. I mean, I'm pretty good because I'm a loud voice, but you know, not everybody has my personality.
Yeah, I do think we need to evaluate the printing and distribution. In episode 16, I spoke with Carla Olson from Patagonia Books. Definitely recommend listening to her and tuning in with Timber Books as well from Ventura. Carla is extremely knowledgeable about green publishing, and that is an area that I feel we really need to be looking at. As readers, we need to be calling publishing houses, small, medium presses, printers, and asking them if they're using 100% post-consumer waste paper that has been recycled. And if not, why not?
Well, and you get, whether it's anything like, hey, you should be using better packaging material versus, you know, you, as well as distribution center representation, as well as pricing, you know, ability to argue. And again, we don't have enough printing presses in the US. Our books are mostly printed and bound overseas. Or in Canada or Mexico. You know, we're really struggling with this. It's why everything slowed down to a halt this summer. We're still catching up. We still are continually running out of much needed books. And who is hurt by the most? Who's the bottom of the food chain? Independent bookstores. And we're, you know, having these conversations with our customers to be like, by the way, you know, they are sending those to Amazon before they're sending them to me. You know, it's very obvious. We know this. They're sending them to Target. And, you know, from a purely pure sense, well, they're selling more. So of course they are. We're trying to save voices. And it really is a situation where we're going to have to look at the whole big picture and start over again.
And Hannah, what is one book you would like to see more people reading?
It's a book by Feminist Press, and it's called Training School for Negro Girls. It's by Camille Acker. I love it. So I fell in love with this book. I think it's maybe 4 years old now. Time is meaningless. So apologies if that's wrong.
But You're completely forgiven. The last year has been a time warp.
I don't know what time is anymore. It's a short story collection. It's gorgeous. It's the, you know, best depiction, I would say, since Robert P. Jones of Washington, D.C. Like I said, it's from Feminist Press, which is a wonderful independent press that people should check out and read just everything they publish. But yeah, I love it. It's delightful. It gets into that gray area and nuance, whether it's about gentrification or being quote unquote the right kind of Black or working in the federal government and being Black. And there's delight. There's the full breadth and depth of womanhood. I mean, it's a fabulous collection and I wish more people knew about it.
And I'll make sure to put the link for this book via Loyalty Bookstores in the show notes.
On our shelves now.
And are you on bookshop.org or IndieBound?
We are on bookshop.org and we also have our own fully functional website. We do both.
Hannah, thank you so much for everything you've done, everything you continue to do for social justice, especially Black Lives Matter. Thank you. And it's been great chatting with you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to talk to you. And I thank you for this very in-depth podcast. It's really wonderful.
Please note you can now find information about episodes on Instagram and Facebook at The Bookshop Podcast, rather than on my author pages. So please follow me there and at Mandy Jackson Beverly Author if you'd like to know more about my books, the workshops I offer, and conferences where I'm speaking. You can also go to my website at mandyjacksonbeverly.com and sign up for my newsletter. Enjoy the show. From bookshop to author. K.P. Kyle was born and raised in Richmond, Virginia, where her mother was the founder and owner of the much-loved independent bookstore Narnia Children's Books. She received her BA from the University of Chicago and her DVM from Cornell University. She has lived in South Boston, Massachusetts, for the past 16 years, with the exception of 2 years spent in Senegal. She works as a veterinarian and shares her home with a bush dog and a black dog. Hi, Kathleen, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. I've been really excited about this.
I can only see one of your dogs. Where's the other one?
No, the other one's on the floor over there. There's only one that's decided she wants to be on my lap.
It's funny, isn't it, how they sense when you're on the phone or when you need to do an interview, because I've had to actually lock my dog and cats out of the room. Otherwise, they're all over me. They need our attention.
They do, especially when you don't need them there.
That's for sure. Now, Kathleen, you're not only an author, but you're a veterinarian. Is that correct?
I am. Yeah, I'm an emergency vet.
And what led you to join the Peace Corps?
You know, I got to be around my sort of mid to late 30s. And, you know, that's the point, I think, when a lot of people have a little bit of a personal reckoning, maybe a midlife crisis, you know, Certainly, I saw that a lot of my friends were getting married and having kids, and that's not something that I wanted to do, but sort of look down the future and wonder, you know, when is anything going to change? And so having a little bit of a life crisis, I thought, well, I'll just do this thing that I always said that I wanted to do and never got around to doing. So I joined the Peace Corps, and it was great.
And where did the Peace Corps send you?
So when I joined, which was a few years back now, when you joined Peace Corps, you didn't get a choice in where you went. That's changed. Now, when you apply to Peace Corps, you can select the area that you want to go in. But when I joined, they sent you where they wanted to. So I didn't actually select Senegal at the time. I have to say I was relatively ignorant about a lot of things. And I didn't even know where Senegal was. They said, you're going to Senegal. And it was like, okay, where? But I'm really, really glad that they did send me there, because otherwise I don't think I would have learned so much about it. And it is an incredible country, just a beautiful country with incredible, welcoming, friendly people. One of the true characteristics of the Senegalese sort of society is this concept called charanga, which basically means hospitality or welcoming. So it is one of the basic tenets of the people of Senegal, is, you know, to welcome strangers even into their homes, you know, share a meal with them. I lived with a family while I was there, who really, you know, did everything they could to include me in things, to involve me in things. And so did the rest of my neighborhood. So anyway, long story short.
I'm fascinated by this. Now, what kind of work did they have you do?
I was an urban agricultural extension agent, meaning I was supposed to be teaching people how to garden better, which was hilarious because I cannot garden to save my life. So they, you know, I joked that they sent me out there to teach people how to grow tomatoes in the desert. The people who were there were already much better at growing tomatoes in the desert than I was. So I showed up, you know, with my little book of tricks of the trade and stuff and said, this is what you're supposed to do. Oh, and they would say, okay, show us your garden. I'm like, no, I don't want to see my garden. So I don't think I was terribly successful as an agriculture agent, but I had other projects that were more successful. So I sort of looked toward them when I want to justify why I went.
And didn't you start writing a blog while you were there?
I did. And it was a lot of fun. It wasn't hugely popular. I think it was read only by my immediate family and some of my friends' parents. But it was a lot of fun. It gave me sort of projects to, you know, to occupy my time, that sort of thing.
I think it's great you had that creative outlet. Now, when did the idea for writing a book come to be?
So I'd always sort of wanted to write a book, because everybody does, right? Everybody has this sort of notion that, like, I could be a novelist if only I just tried. And I never had before, because honestly, I think I was kind of a coward, you know? As long as I didn't try, I could never say that I failed. So I just sort of went around saying, I probably could if I tried, you know, and leave it at that. But then one of the things that I sort of learned about myself, I guess, when I joined Peace Corps is that, you know, these things that scare you, that you sort of assume you probably can't do, and so you're not going to, you know, make the effort, like Peace Corps, which, you know, I hadn't done previously. I think you'd be surprised at how much you can accomplish as an individual if you have a little faith in yourself. So it was that. It was also that you start thinking, if I don't try, I'll never succeed. And, you know, even though it seemed like a scary thing, and it was a scary thing to, you know, not so much to write it, the writing was actually quite fun, but putting it out there and waiting for people to judge it was very, very scary. And of course, everybody hears about this, you know, you write your, you know, great American novel and you send it out to publishers and then the rejections just start rolling in. And that hurts. You know, you send it out, you think you've done a great job and somebody says, nah, don't like it. But I was extremely fortunate in that I sent it out to a number of small presses. And after about probably 6 months after I sent it out to Allium, that they responded and said, we'd like to, you know, see the full manuscript. And it was about a year after I first sent it out that that they contacted me and said, we'd like to publish it. And that was possibly one of the happiest moments of my life.
That's actually a pretty short turnaround. I mean, some people wait years and years and years. Let's talk about your novel. It's called Sync. It is a cross-genre sci-fi thriller with some romance and a parallel universe. Was there a specific moment when the idea for the story appeared, or did it just kind of morph into your world?
There were a couple of moments like that. One is I was on vacation with my family in Taos, New Mexico. We go there every winter for the skiing and also because it's quite beautiful. And we were driving down the road and there was this kid hitchhiking on the side of the road. And, you know, we did not actually stop and pick him up, but I saw him and I thought, gee, I wonder what his story is. That must be interesting. I'm not sure why or when exactly I started thinking that this is going to be a, you know, like a multiverse story. I know at one point I was trying to figure out how the multiverse would work. And of course, I'm not a physicist, so it's a fun thing to think about, but it's a confusing thing if you start, you know, really, really delving into it. But to be honest, a lot of the book, I didn't have much of a plan. I didn't know exactly where it was going. So it turns out there's sort of two categories of approaches to writing, which I only recently learned, well, recently, only, you know, in the last couple of years learned about. One is called plotting, which is fairly straightforward. You know, you outline everything, you make a list of your plot points. And once everything's very clear, you write down your novel. The other one is called pantsing, I think because it's like fly by the seat of your pants, where you just start writing and you see where it goes. And it turns out that I'm very much a pantser. I didn't figure out the ending to the novel until it was probably 2/3 of the way through. But all the same, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the entire process.
Yeah, and I feel that once your characters are embedded in your soul, they kind of take over and lead you and tell you where they want to go. So the plot kind of follows the characters, or it does with me anyway, but I think that's a fun way to write.
Yeah.
Now, can you give us a short synopsis of the story, please?
The basic story is there are two characters. The point of view sort of bounces back and forth between the two of them. Jason is a young man who starts out the book hitchhiking on the side of the road. And the other one is a middle-aged lady named Bridget, who happens to be driving. And for sort of reasons, she picks him up and she feels sorry for him because he's clearly desperately in need of something. And so she decides to give him a place to rest for the night. And then various nefarious characters come in, sort of shady characters come in that turn out that they have been pursuing Jason for some time. And so the two of them go on a run together. And the sort of shady characters are people from Jason's past when he was a participant in an experimental lab that was exploring the possibility of sending people to alternate universes. So bad people from the lab have come to track him down. So that's the basic sort of premise of the book.
It's a fascinating concept. And I was taken with the science part at the beginning about ketosis. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a situation where if you are not metabolizing your blood sugar appropriately, you develop this odor on your breath, this odor of ketones on your breath. And a lot of diabetics, you know, when their insulin isn't administered properly, they will develop this specific odor of ketones on their breath. Not everybody can smell it. And to be completely forthright, I cannot smell it myself, but many of my colleagues can. You can smell it on the breath of diabetic dogs and cats as well. And it also happens when you're starving. So that's why it happened with Jason. Or if you're on the Atkins diet, fun fact.
It helps to have a background in science.
It was one of those sort of fun little, you know, little known facts that I kind of just wanted to throw in because I think it's interesting and entertaining.
And the personalities of Jason and Bridget are kind of quirky and a little opposite of the norm, kind of a switch of the hero. Without giving too much of the story away, can you tell us a little about them, please?
Bridget is, so she's a middle-aged lady. She's going through sort of a rough patch in her life. So she's pretty depressed at the start of the book. And she's got sort of a dry sense of humor. Like, well, she finds it hard to like see joy in everything, even though she may want to. And she tends to be a little bit on the snarky side. And then Jason he's a very sensitive young man, sort of consumed by the love of his life, whom he lost prior to the book starting. Although I'd like to say for the record, there's no fridging in this book.
And for listeners out there who haven't heard this term fridging before, it is, and I quote from the Macmillan Dictionary, a sexist trope in TV, film, etc., in which a female character is killed at the start to give a male character the chance to avenge her, also called WIR, Women in Refrigerators.
But, you know, because of that, I thought about this sometime afterward. Of the two of them, Jason tends to cry with much more frequency than Bridget does. Jason breaks down in tears more than once. And I think it's always justified, but more than once. Whereas Bridget, her default is to get annoyed or angry, which doesn't make her sound like a very pleasant person, but I think she is. And also she's got her dog.
And I love the dog's name, Lithium. Very clever.
Thank you.
I always like to hear from authors about their path from finished manuscript to finding an agent and publisher. Did you work with an editor prior to sending out your manuscript?
I did not. I did send it to a beta reader, which is somebody who will read it and then tell you where your plot holes are, because when you are writing it, everything makes perfect sense. And then when somebody else reads it, they say, nope, none of this.
Yes, that's true.
So I did have a beta reader who I think was very helpful, but I didn't have an editor. I just sort of blithely assumed I could edit my own. And then when Allie and did pick it up, they did edit it for me. So.
And did you have to make many changes after their edit?
Not too many. There were some suggestions. You know, Allium is it's a small press. It's a niche press. And the only thing that Allium puts out are stories that are somehow related to Chicago, which this one was. But because of it, this story starts in Boston and then moves to Chicago. And so one of the things was, can you put more scenes playing up the setting of Chicago? So I did write some extra scenes just to sort of refocus the book on Chicago. But I mean, the overall story itself, no, she was basically let me have my own head.
Let's talk about your writing process. Are you currently writing around full-time work? And do you find the transition from veterinarian to writer easy?
Yeah, I'm still working. The way that I wrote that one was I would come home from work and then I would spend a couple of hours writing every night. I don't think I can still do that because these days I'm getting home at 4 a.m. and I just don't have it in me. So these days I tend to write early in the day before I have to, you know, so that I can go to bed when I need to go to bed. But I do try to put something down every day, even though, you know, even if I don't have a whole lot of time. Because I think otherwise, when you start letting yourself slip and think maybe today I'll just skip it, you know, one day turns into two, turns into four. And then the next thing you know, you're like, well, now it's too far gone and I can't start it again.
Yes, there's a lot to be said for continuity. And are you currently working on a new book?
There's a couple of things that I'm working on right now. Ironically, I had been about a quarter of the way through a book on a pandemic before everything happened. So I abandoned that one because I just, you know, that's too much. I am currently working on something about a serial killer, which may or may not come to a satisfying conclusion. And there's a political thriller that I finished a while back that I'm sort of trying to shop around and see if anybody's interested in it. And then there is a psychological thriller that I finished the first draft of, and now I'm debating whether I want to go back and see if it's worth a second draft. I think I probably will eventually, but I have to let it alone for a while.
Yes, placing the finished manuscript in a drawer and leaving it for a while so that it can brew and settle is a great idea and an important part of the writing process.
Yeah.
Now, Kathleen, you are no stranger to indie bookshops. Can you share with us your story of your mom's bookshop and how it was growing up with that world of books around you?
So my mother, when I was about seven, opened a children's bookstore in Richmond, Virginia. It was called Narnia Children's Books. And at the time, it was one of two specifically children's bookstores. The other one was called Edward T. Rabbit. And so for the next, really until I graduated and went off to college, every afternoon after school, my sisters and I would get on the city bus and head down to Carytown, where the bookstore was, and hang out in the bookstore until it was closing time. So I basically spent pretty much every afternoon through middle school and high school when I wasn't, you know, doing some after-school activity at the bookstore. Which was great. I was a very shy little girl, like when I was in kindergarten and stuff. I don't think I spoke at all in kindergarten, but I read a lot. So it was great for me because already I was inclined to spend my time reading as opposed to anything else. And then, you know, you're sort of stuck in this essentially your own personal library. And it was all children's books. So it was basically a little paradise. I spent a lot of time sitting between the stacks, just reading anything that had a cover that looked like it interested me. And also little things that you...
Oops, slight interruption while one of the dogs gets comfortable.
Yes, she's gotten bored of one side. Sorry.
While she's getting comfortable, was there one specific genre that interests you more than others as a little girl?
I was a big fan of fantasy when I was little. There are a series of books called, I want to say they're called Dragon's Blood or Heart's Blood, that were about these competitive dragon duels and in, you know, some of those other planet or other world or whatever. And I was a big fan of those. I was certainly fortunate because authors would come to the store and so I would be introduced to their stuff. Like Lois Lowry came and did some signings at the store. And I read, I mean, of course, everybody reads Lois Lowry. I was a big fan of hers. My dog, prior to these two, I had a bulldog whose name was Rabble Starkey after the book. And, you know, there was a period when I was in high school when I was very, very into vampires. This is pre-Twilight, well pre-Twilight, but I certainly ran a lot of Anne Rice and that sort of thing. And I've always liked, you know, sort of adventure books, that sort of thing. I've tended to prefer stories where a lot of stuff is happening.
Yeah, I'll say I'm the same. I really enjoy multi-layered books. Even if they're different periods going back and forth from real time to historical periods, I love that kind of thing. And while we're talking about books, is there one book, apart from your own, you would like to see more people reading?
Children's or adults?
In honor of your mother's store, why don't you give us one children's and an adult's?
Okay. So one of my favorite books when I was very young was a collection of Scandinavian fairy tales called East of the Sun and West of the Moon, which, you know, some of them I think I could still recite at this point. I read it so often, and it's still out there. One of my favorite picture books was a book called The Ship's Cat, which is by Richard Adams, he of Watership Down. And that, as far as I know, sadly is out of print, but it's a poem about a pirate cat, and it's great. I love it. As to adult, I mean, one of my favorite books that I go back to a lot is a book called A Dead Man in Deptford, which is by Anthony Burgess. He's best known for A Clockwork Orange, which I also love, although he hated it. Hilarious. But A Dead Man in Deptford is about Christopher Marlowe, you know, Shakespeare's contemporary, who was arguably a more interesting person than Shakespeare, at least if you believe this book. But it's written in Elizabethan English, essentially. So it's very flowery writing, and it talks about Marlowe, not just as a playwright, but also as a spy. It's a fantastic book, and I've read it over and over again. I still love it.
Yet another one to go on my TBR list. Kathleen, you spent a lot of your childhood growing up in a bookshop, as you've already explained, your mother's bookshop. So I was thinking you might have some words of advice for readers out there looking to buy books specifically at this time during the pandemic and how they can support bookshops.
I think this is going to be somewhat preaching to the choir, but I know it is very easy for people to turn to Amazon when they want to buy a book. But we have so many other options. And I know that like now is not the time necessarily to be going into little shops and spending a lot of time in close proximity to people. But bookshop.org and IndieBound are both websites where you can buy a book not on Amazon and have, you know, at least part of the price go to independent bookstores in your area. You can order directly from a bookstore. You can arrange for curbside pickup. So one of the big issues when my mom had her bookstore in the 90s was that Barnes & Noble came out. I mean, Barnes & Noble basically demolished the small bookstores back in the day. We used to call it the evil empire. Everybody would go there and you know, buy the books. Sometimes people would get sneaky and try to return them to my mom's bookstore. And sometimes they would go to Narnia and ask for suggestions and then say, well, I'm going to go buy it at Barnes & Noble where it's cheaper. And it's the same with Amazon. I know it's cheaper at Amazon. I know it's convenient, but Jeff Bezos does not need any more money. He's got plenty, you know?
And for a really in-depth discussion about this, I suggest listeners go to episode 8, where I interview Alison Hill, CEO of the American Booksellers Association. Alison does an incredible job of explaining where your money goes when you buy from an independent bookshop, as opposed to buying on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah. And it is more personal. You know, Amazon uses an algorithm to suggest books for you. But somebody else on your show recently talked about this. I mean, they suggest books based on what you've already bought. Well, you know, you're never going to expand your personal horizon if you just keep reading the same sort of variants over and over again. And that I thought was an excellent point.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, the books I have enjoyed the most are when a bookseller has asked me about the kind of books I read and enjoy, and they suggest a book for me. It's always been a fantastic book, one which I would not have seen had I relied on an Amazon algorithm. Kathleen, thank you so much for being on the show. I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and it's fun hearing the background of someone's life who, as a child, was raised in a bookshop. It's fascinating. And also, thank you for all you do for animals.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on. This was so much fun.
And thank you for listening. Remember, buy local, read global, support your local indie bookshop. I'll see you around the corner. For updates about the show, make sure to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Mandy Jackson Beverly.